Please be seated. Before I call our third case of the day, I want to let counsel and others who are here of interest that Justice Shirley Abraham's son will not be participating in this case. She's not here at oral argument and will not be participating. So with that brief announcement, I don't have any school this afternoon, so I guess we're ready to proceed with State versus Bell. Are you ready to go, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Hagopian, and I represent Gerard Bell. Well, I assume that the prosecutor knew heading into trial that he had some real challenges in this case. There was no DNA evidence, no other eyewitnesses to the alleged assaults, no admission from Mr. Bell. There was delayed reporting, particularly by the older sister, and a general lack of cooperation by the younger sister. But those challenges cannot allow the prosecutor to do what he did in this case, which was to repeatedly distort for the jury the burden of proof. And he did that multiple times, and he did that concerning a jury instruction on burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is probably the greatest protection for a defendant at a criminal trial. He did this by striking two foul blows, though on multiple occasions. And the statements went like this, beginning in voir dire: if these sisters are lying, there should be evidence of a reason for them to lie. And then by closing argument, telling the jury that the defendant has presented no evidence of a reason for them to lie, just speculation. And then secondly, posing the question in closing argument, what must we believe in order for the defendant to be not guilty? And answering it 14 times by telling them that they would have to believe that the state's witnesses, the two sisters, are lying.
Counsel, isn't that wasn't part of defense counsel's theory of the case that the sisters were compulsive liars and should not be believed?
Yes, okay. It was. But
so wasn't the state's case simply a refutation of that premise?
There's several problems with that. The most basic is, of course, that the theory of defense presented cannot change the burden of proof. The state's obligation at trial is to prove each element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't matter what the theory of defense is. That's their burden.
That's true, but this is argument, right?
Well, it started in voir dire.
Okay. So, this was not part of their presentation of evidence, right?
Some of it was made before there was any evidence.
So let's start with the closing arguments and work our way backwards. So at closing arguments, that certainly was argument, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And it was a refutation of defense counsel's premise, yes?
Well, I mean, it gets a little tricky because some of this started it wasn't just in rebuttal, but in the prosecutor's closing argument. So this cannot all be dismissed as an invited response.
Well, but that was part of the theory of the case for the defense, right? So the defense counsel was trying to show that the sisters were compulsive liars. Isn't that true?
That was part of the theory of defense. But look where that leads. If this court agrees with the Court of Appeals that these sort of misstatements of the law are proper, then that means when the defense theory is that the state's witnesses are lying, that the defendant then, what, carries some burden to prove that the witnesses are lying and to prove a motive for them to lie? That's not right.
So your argument, of course, is premised on the idea that the state was misrepresenting the burden of proof. But isn't this really an objection to the state's logic of their argument rather than a misstatement of the law?
No,
shouldn't we look at this as believing the sisters is both a necessary and sufficient condition for conviction, but disbelieving the sisters, while a sufficient condition for acquittal, is not a necessary condition. Isn't that the problem with how those pieces of logic line up?
I don't think this is all limited to either an argument over the facts or sort of just a statement of logic. I would ask the court to look very closely at the statements that are challenged here, because I think what becomes very clear is that when the prosecutor was making these assertions, he was tying them back to the reasonable doubt instruction. So he is expressly telling the jury, this is what the law requires. So, for example, in voir dire, when he engages in this colloquy of you would expect there to be evidence of a reason for them to lie, he goes on to say, and I'm on, this is document 84, pages 71 to 73, you're going to hear the jury instructions on reasonable doubt. You're not allowed to speculate. If you weren't to hear evidence of why a person might lie, would you feel inclined to speculate? Or would you just follow the jury instructions and not speculate and base your decision on the evidence or lack of evidence? So he is telling the jurors a couple of things. One is that the defendant has a burden to present evidence showing a motive, a reason for them to lie. And
which part of that was the state saying the defendant has a burden?
Because preceding the reference to what the jury instructions will tell them, mm-hmm. he has spun this line of, do you think that there would be evidence showing a reason for the witnesses to lie? If they are lying, would there be evidence of a reason?
So the state cannot mention a motivation for lying?
The state referred to a reason for them to lie. He also referred repeatedly to a reason, evidence of a reason for them to lie, motive.
Can't the state inquire into that?
The state cannot tell the jury that the defendant has any burden to prove anything.
Well, now, you're reading burden into that language. There's nothing in the language there that says the defendant has any burden at all. The state is commenting on what it believes will and will not be producing evidence, isn't it?
Well, I think it would only be a common sense interpretation that if, as they were told by the prosecutor, that they should expect there will be evidence of a reason for the state's witnesses to lie, mm-hmm. who would be presenting that evidence other than the defendant?
So is it out of bounds to suggest to the jury that there might be reasons for a witness to lie?
No.
Okay. And then would it be out of bounds for the state to say you're not going to hear of any evidence of a motive to lie?
What that is closer to being permissible. I think the problem...
Are you saying that's not permissible?
No, I think that these cases involving prosecutorial misconduct, you have to look very closely at both the content and the timing. So if in, for example, rebuttal argument, after defense counsel has made arguments as to why the jury should conclude that the state's witnesses are lying, I think the prosecutor can say, defense counsel would like you to believe that these sisters are lying. The evidence does not support that contention. I believe there is something very wrong about before there's any evidence to even talk about in a case for the prosecutor to tell the jury that you should expect there to be evidence of a reason for the sisters to lie, because who would present that evidence? Nobody but the defendant.
Well, first off, I think it was a question, wasn't it?
Well, this is in voir dire.
Right.
So it's a question and response. Yeah. But I would ask the court to read those questions and responses very carefully. I don't think one could draw a conclusion other than the prosecutor is telling the jury what to expect as far as telling them that the jury instruction will tell them that they can't speculate about why they might lie. There must be evidence of a reason for them to lie.
So jury instruction does tell them they can't speculate.
Right. But in that respect, the prosecutor is now conflating the reasonable doubt instruction with the instruction to the jury on how to assess credibility. When assessing credibility, which this case, that's what it was about, right? It was all about assessing credibility. The jury can engage in some level of speculation because they can consider a whole host of factors in deciding whether they believe the witness is credible, including things like the witness's conduct, appearance, demeanor, apparent intelligence. That doesn't mean either side has to come forth with evidence showing the IQ of the witness. The jury's allowed to draw their own assessment. There's some speculation involved in that.
Are you saying that's an exception from the jury instruction that they shall not speculate?
That the speculation language that appears in reasonable doubt is talking about the state's burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that they are not to speculate, but this is twisted around into the defendant has a burden to prove a reason for the girls to lie, and anything short of actual proof of a reason for them to lie is pure speculation, and you can't consider that. But that's not right, because when assessing credibility, look what it says about motives. A jury may consider possible motives for falsifying testimony. It doesn't say you must conclude that the witness is telling the truth unless there is evidence showing a reason for them to lie. The jury can draw inferences that that might be a possible motive. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. That's permissible when assessing credibility. And what the prosecutor did was to conflate the reasonable doubt instruction with the assessment of witness credibility. And he did so in a way that is so damaging because he left the jury with the impression that you can't acquit unless you conclude the sisters are lying. And if they are lying, there must be evidence showing a reason for them to lie. And the defense has presented no such evidence, just speculation. But you know what? Defense counsel did present evidence from which a jury could infer that they may not be credible. He didn't have actual proof of a motive to lie. He didn't have a diary entry that says, I'm getting Mr. Bell, I want him out of our lives. But he did a thorough cross-examination, bringing out various inconsistencies. He brought out the fact that indeed they had lied in these proceedings about the amount of alcohol the younger sister had to drink. He did actually quite a lovely job in providing inferences as to why the jury might doubt their credibility.
Well, if defense counsel did a lovely job of presenting that kind of evidence, why did the state's argument not just implicitly direct the jury right to what defense counsel elicited?
Why did the state's argument?
Right. So the state says, don't speculate. You know, you've got, find a reason why the witness might lie. You say defense counsel did a great job of demonstrating why witness might have lied. So the sum total of those two things would seem to be that the state said, well, go look at that evidence that defense counsel said was indicating that she was lying.
Well, to the extent he told them to go look at it, what he told them to do with it is to dismiss all of it, not just because the prosecutor found it unpersuasive, but again, going back to directing the jury to the jury instruction on reasonable doubt and telling them that you can't consider that. That's just all speculation.
But where did he say that you can't, that the jury could not consider the evidence that defense counsel elicited about their motivation to lie?
This appears in the rebuttal argument. It's document number 87, and it begins really with how he begins the rebuttal is by again referring to the reasonable doubt instruction. And then he, on page 679, line 6, tells them if he, and he premises this with, if you find yourself considering defense counsel's arguments about why they might lie, you can't do that because that's mere speculation. And this is a direct quote. If you find yourself doing that, the instructions say specifically you cannot do it. You cannot base it on mere guesswork or speculation.
Right. So that's his comment on the nature of the evidence, right? He says that's not really evidence of motive to lie. That's just speculation.
Well, he's done this in the context where he began his case in voir dire by telling them that there needed to be evidence of a reason for them to lie. And then he's sewn it up in the end, and I recall also in voir dire told them the instructions wouldn't allow them to speculate, and now has sewn it up in rebuttal by telling them that everything that the defense has argued that would create an inference to question the credibility of these witnesses is something you can't consider under the jury instruction on reasonable doubt that governs the state's burden. The defendant has no burden at a trial. I think we can all agree on that. And just because the defense's theory is that the state's witnesses are lying, that doesn't alter that burden of proof. That doesn't mean that now the defense has some burden to prove these witnesses are lying, nor that they have some burden to prove a reason for them to lie.
So generally juries get instructed that they are they can refer to their normal human experience in life as they consider the evidence in front of them, right?
Yes.
Okay. So is it a part of normal human experience that one would expect that if someone's going to lie, they'd have reason for doing so?
Yes. And that's why these arguments are so harmful, because do you know where I think that assumption is strongest? In a child sex case.
Right. So if that is part of the general human experience, that reasonably expect that if someone's going to lie, they have a reason for it, can the state comment on that?
The state cannot comment in any way that shifts the burden to the defense to prove a reason for them to lie. That's just obvious.
Right. Yeah,
burden
yeah,
shifting.
He can't shift the burden, but he can comment on the lack of evidence, can't he?
He could. I could imagine in rebuttal, after defense counsel has argued various inferences that could be drawn to question the credibility, decide that they are lying, for the prosecutor to say, defense counsel wants you to disbelieve these sisters' testimony. The evidence does not support that conclusion. They're telling the truth. And then the prosecutor can go on and discuss how he interprets the evidence. Different inferences can be drawn from the same piece of evidence, especially dealing with something as fuzzy as assessing credibility. That's all okay. But I think that when the court looks at these comments, you have to look at the content, what exactly was said. I think that it's really significant and really harmful to the state's position that when he was making these arguments, he wasn't talking about the facts. He was tying it back to the jury instruction on reasonable doubt. So he's telling the jury what the instruction requires. That's a problem. And I think in addition to content, you need to look at timing. And by timing, I mean both when it occurred and how frequently. And this is not a case like many other cases where there may be somewhat questionable statements made by the prosecutor in rebuttal argument. For example, the defense argues, well, we never heard from Joe. Joe was there. State never put Joe on the witness stand. So the prosecutor gets up and says, hey, You know, the defendant has subpoena power, too. Those kind of comments have generally, that's okay, because it's talking just about the facts. It's not talking about what the jury instructions require the jury to do. It's a fair comment on the facts, and it's responding to something that the defense counsel was arguing in closing argument. But here, we have two significant differences. These are not statements merely arguing the facts. They're arguing the law, what the law requires. And these statements began even before there were any facts to talk about. So, yes, some of the comments, it all got sewn up in rebuttal, but the path was led by the prosecutor right from voir dire. It's an unusual case that way. I've cited quite a bit of authority from other jurisdictions that have found to be patently improper the assertion that you cannot acquit unless you conclude that the state's witnesses are lying.
Counsel, I want to jump in and hit that law now. That you're on your yellow light. You advanced two theories regarding the alleged misstatements. Number one, theory based on plain error, and number two, based on ineffective assistance of counsel, both of which you asked for a new trial. Of course, they provide a different analytical framework together with a different burden of proof, one on the plaintiff, or one on the state, rather, one on the defendant. Which is the stronger of your two arguments, do you think? Given the difference in analysis, I mean, the plain error requires it's fundamental, obvious, and substantial error, and the ineffective assistance of counsel, of course, is Strickland. Again, state having the burden in the former, the defense having the burden in the latter.
I think that by far it makes the most sense to address this case under plain error.
I thought you were going to say that because traditionally you're going to lead with your right, and that's what you led with. You know, that argument came first in your briefs. But there is, I think, a hesitation, I know, on my part, and case law indicates some hesitation also, in going the plain error route. In other words, we have cases that say that plain error should be used sparingly. Can you address why this is one of those sparingly situations?
I would ask the court to take a close look at what was a unanimous decision of this court in 2008, State versus Jorgensen, where there the court did use the plain error doctrine to reverse, and in part due to prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument. There are some parallels there, one being that the error that was addressed there involved an impingement of a defendant's fundamental constitutional right, just like this case. So in that case, the concern was with a violation of the defendant's right of confrontation and due process. Here, the error we're talking about is not just some evidentiary error. It goes to a very significant constitutional violation, which is the due process right that the state prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And also, I would add that Sullivan versus Louisiana provides support for the notion that a constitutional error of this sort, a distortion of the reasonable doubt instruction, is something so significant that it would rise to the level of requiring reversal without showing prejudice even, because in Sullivan they found that the defective reasonable doubt instruction was structural error. So I think it certainly makes sense then when we have prosecutors' arguments that are distorting the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that that would appropriately be treated as plain error, which still does have a harmless error component, but it's the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. The state, in its brief, did not make an effort to meet that standard under the plain error test. I don't think they can meet it given that we all seem to be in agreement that this case was all about credibility. The state's entire case really hinged on trying to convince the jury that the sisters should be believed. The defense theory was that the sisters should not be believed, and that the arguments that are challenged here really distorted how the jury could reach its verdict in light of what was in dispute here, that they had to conclude that they're lying, and the defense had a burden to prove a reason for them to lie. I would also note that there are three of the cases that I've cited where this sort of error was reversed under a plain error theory, that is Vargas from the Seventh Circuit, and also a Delaware Supreme Court decision in Morris versus State, where they also used plain error. And in fact, went so far as to say that the kind of argument that was made here, telling the jury that in order to acquit, they have to believe the state witnesses are lying, is so patently wrong that the trial judge, they believe, had an obligation to sua sponte, intervene, and speak up. Do you recall what happened here? Defense counsel objected, and the objection was overruled. So the jury was left with the impression that there was nothing wrong with that argument.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien appears on behalf of the state. As it does with respect to any case challenging the propriety of a prosecutor's closing argument, this Court's focus is far broader than the few words or phrases that the defense doesn't like in the argument. This Court's focus, especially in the more recent cases of State v. Burns and State v. Hurley, as this Court clearly pointed out, the focus is on the entire record. The focus is on the entire closing argument of the prosecutor. The focus is on the defense argument. The focus is on all of the evidence adduced at trial and all the trial proceedings.
Counsel,
and most importantly,
counsel,
the focus...
That sounds like a harmless error analysis. Let's focus first on whether there was error.
I agree with the Court of Appeals that there was no error here.
All right.
That this was a fair comment on the diametrically opposed viewpoints presented by the defense and the state, which, counsel is correct, began in voir dire. Not only did the prosecutor have questions about reasons for teenagers to lie about sexual assault, so did defense counsel. And he went at some length into, is it possible that children, that teenagers could just make this all up? This case was a witch hunt. These girls were compulsive liars. Those aren't my words. Those were defense counsel's words in his closing argument. This was, he cited to the Salem witch hunt trials. When you review the entire propriety of this case, or the propriety of the argument in light of what went on at trial, you can't just ignore the defense theory. You can't ignore defense counsel's opening and closing arguments, which focused, honed in on these girls are lying. And the obvious question becomes for the jury, are they lying? And if so, why? And the prosecutor tried to answer that best as he could in his closing argument. And he emphasized, yes, he did refer regularly to the reasonable doubt jury instruction, which is JI 140, which says that you are to acquit if there is a reasonable hypothesis consistent with innocence, and he harped on and on again that there is no reasonable hypothesis here. There is a hypothesis. Defense counsel speculated about all sorts of things, but there is no reasonable hypothesis.
Let's focus for a moment on the structure of the argument that the prosecutor made, beginning with the voir dire. So he made an argument and statements that were structured like this. You may not acquit unless X. If X is a statement that you know, unless defendant shows this kind of evidence, you can't acquit. Is that appropriate?
No. If he specifically says, because that would be directly contrary to the instructions. If he says the defense has to show, what we have here is...
Let's say it's, unless you hear evidence of X, you must acquit. Can he say that?
I would say that's cross. That's getting very close to the line if it does not cross it, because then that, when in that using that phraseology, you're implying that there is a defense burden. I think the difference here is that when he asks these questions, what must we believe? What must we believe? Why are these girls lying? He's saying the defense took it upon itself to show that they're lying. And yet we look at the evidence that was produced, and there's no evidence of a motive for them to lie. There's no reason for them. We haven't seen it. It's not here.
His statements were a little more direct than that, though, weren't they?
Pardon me?
His statements were a little more direct than that, weren't they? He said, you should not quit unless you find some reason why these sisters would lie.
But again, in that situation, it gets back to, as the Court of Appeals correctly viewed it, where these statements are in the context of a case that was where you had two diametrically opposed viewpoints of the evidence, where the defense theory was not that we don't know what the truth is, or we don't know if they're telling the truth. The defense theory was they are lying, and the state's theory is they are not. And then you delve into reasons and why, and I think it's fair game for a prosecutor to say, there's no reason to acquit here because these girls told the truth and there's no reason to question their testimony. I mean, now you can debate whether there in fact were reasons, whether their dysfunctional upbringing caused them to lie, whether there was some jealousy or whatnot. But I think it's fair to say there's really no basis for that, and that's pure speculation. So to extrapolate from that, therefore, you should find him guilty, or therefore, there's no reason to disbelieve them, and therefore, you should not acquit. I think, now we're getting into the area of phraseology more than black and white, clearly reversible error, clearly no error. We're in an area where, as the jury instructions allow, you can comment not only on the evidence but on the lack of evidence.
But didn't the prosecutor say that in order to find Bell not guilty, they would, quote, have to believe, unquote, or must believe that the sisters were lying?
That was the words. Basically, that's what was said. And that's how the Court of Appeals analyzed it, as this, quote, must believe.
So how's that substantively different from you cannot acquit unless you hear evidence of X?
The way I think that what that is, again, it ties into his argument. There's no reasonable hypothesis consistent with innocence here. When you look at this evidence, there's no reason to acquit here. You must find him guilty because there's no reasonable hypothesis. And he points to, especially in rebuttal, where the defense did try to come up with all kinds of hypotheses as to why they might be lying. And he said, and he argued, look, they've come out with all these reasons, but none of them are reasonable. Therefore, there's no basis to acquit. I think in that context, I think it's fair. Now, when you get close to the line where you say they didn't present evidence or there is no evidence, it gets close. But I think what he's really saying there is not the defense didn't present evidence. It's their hypothesis is not reasonable based on the evidence that came in.
Counsel, didn't the prosecutor say there is no evidence in the close? I think in his argument in closing, he returned to some of the themes he was weaving in voir dire. He said,
We talked about if somebody is going to make a flat-out lie about something, they're going to have a reason. They're going to have some evidence of that reason. Who's the they that they're referring to, that he's referring to, do you think? And later on they say, if a person lies about something, they must have a reason. And the reason why there is no evidence in this case about why anybody would lie is because they're not lying.
But again, I think when you look at the context of how the evidence came in, you had extensive cross-examination of both of the victims by defense counsel, extensive cross-examination of the officers, challenging their credibility, delving into possible reasons why they would be making this up. And I think that that interpretation is, you heard the evidence, there's nothing, you heard that cross-examination, there's nothing to convince you that they're lying. I mean, I think that that's, you know, as the Court of Appeals looked at it, that was a comment on the evidence that was presented. And the lack thereof from, as the case unfolded, and including what's drawn out in cross-examination, what's drawn out in the police reports, what was drawn out in the videotapes of the girls when they were interviewed, in the defendant's own statement where he can't come up with a reason, his own police statement, where that evidence is very powerful. He says, I didn't do it. And the officer asks, well, do you have any idea why? I have no clue. So these girls are making it up, apparently, for fun. And, you know, and that's where defense counsel then tries to tie this into the Salem witch hunt trials, that just like those girls, there was no reason, there was no evidence of a reason for this, this defendant to terrorize these girls.
Who was supposed to proffer this evidence?
Pardon me?
When you say there was no evidence, who is supposed to proffer that evidence?
Well, the defense normally, when you're cross-examining a victim, you hope you can develop something that will show that they have a reason to lie, and then you can argue off of that. Or you, maybe the defendant himself, in his statement to the police, would say, look, this happened a few months ago, and they're upset about it. Usually there's something that you can run with.
Hope is different than burden. I don't want to talk about hope. I want to talk about burden. So who has the burden to produce that evidence that's missing?
Well, the state doesn't have to produce evidence of a motive if there isn't any.
Mm-hmm. So who does? The defendant?
But then you don't just ignore it in closing argument.
Who
I mean, I don't see there's any case law that says the state, if there's absent motive, I mean, the credibility instruction clearly says that you can consider the motives to falsify.
Sure. And who has the burden of showing the motive to lie? The prosecutor several times says, there's no evidence that they're lying. There's no evidence of their lying. So who has the burden to show that there's evidence of lying?
Well, the state has a burden to prove that there's that the witnesses are telling the truth.
And then the answer to my question is, who has the burden of demonstrating there's
well,
no
I would
evidence
suggest
of lying?
It, I would suggest, and you often see it, where a defendant will assume a burden depending on his theory of defense. And if the theory of defense is they're lying, it would help your defense if there was some proof of a motive. Even though you have no burden, technically you have no burden of proof, many times a defense will take on a burden of proof depending on the theory of defense. If the theory of defense here is we don't know what the truth is and we don't know if they're lying or not, but the state hasn't proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt, then they're not going to assume that burden and they're going to put the burden on the state.
Doesn't the state always have the burden in a criminal case?
Well, sure, the problem I have with these cases, with prosecutors' argument, is the focus is so narrow on specific words and phrases, and it doesn't, as this Court has said in Burns and Hurley, focus on the entire record, which includes the defense theory,
yeah,
which
then you
includes
get to, just as at the outset of the argument, Justice Kelly said, now you're talking harmless error. You know, you look at the whole context of things, and even though the statements may have been misstatements on the law or referencing a burden that doesn't exist. But when you look at the totality of the circumstances and the context and all this sort of stuff, any error was harmless. I mean, that's what it sounds like you're going to now.
Well, I think it could be either. It could either harmless error or, as the Court of Appeals did when it looked at the entire record and the totality, said, in context, there was really no error here. He was tying it into the reasonable doubt instruction. And the gist of the argument was they have not there is no reasonable hypothesis consistent with innocence, and you heard the evidence. They argued all these things, but that's just pure speculation. That, and you can't speculate. You have to base it on the evidence. And, you know, the reasonable doubt instruction allows for comment on the evidence and absence of evidence. The credibility instruction allows you to comment on the motive or lack of motive for someone to falsify. So, you know, I think the Court of Appeals got it right in saying this really wasn't error. You know, maybe it gets close to the line, and that's why, you know, sometimes it's not clear whether you've gone over it or not, but it's certainly not reversible whether you think it's error or not, because, you know, and I would cite, you know, counsel refers to the Seventh Circuit line of cases. I would refer this court to the United States v. Common C-O-M-M-O-N decision that I cited and quoted in my brief, and the Cornett decision on which it relies. Common was a plain error case where and Cornett was a plain error case, if I recall correctly, where, and I would say that the argument in Common was quite close to this, where the defense theory was that the cops framed the defendant, and the prosecutor basically says, you know, these, all right, go ahead. If you think these cops are corrupt liars, then acquit. You know, that's your, you know, that's what you must believe, that kind of thing. And the court says, you know, we rarely reverse for prosecutorial error in closing argument. We rarely reverse because the other instructions put this all in proper perspective. And the jury is presumed to have followed all of those instructions. As this court has constantly held throughout, that, you know, this jury was instructed on the burden of proof under WIS-JI 140. It was instructed on the credibility of the witness under WIS-JI 300. It had copies of those instructions in the jury room. There was no challenge to the propriety of those instructions. And that jury presumably followed them. And it was told the arguments of counsel are not evidence. You decide this case based on the evidence and the law as given to you. There were no jury questions about, we don't understand the instruction, or we interpreted the prosecutor's argument differently than the reasonable doubt instruction. There was none of that. And the defense counsel argued specifically, here are hypotheses consistent with innocence. And the prosecutor came back at the outset of his rebuttal. He skipped a word. The instruction doesn't say hypotheses consistent with innocence. It says reasonable hypotheses consistent with innocence. And they haven't presented any reasonable hypotheses. Yeah, they can speculate about jealousy and about, you know, they're mad at their mother and this and that. But that's not reasonable. It's still for the jury to decide. Maybe the prosecutor's wrong. And that's what the jury's function is. Well, you know, we've read the reasonable doubt instruction. We followed it, and we think the prosecutor's wrong. Or we agree, these girls, we think they told the truth, and there's no reason, we haven't seen any reason why they would make this all up. This was a family friend. This was not mistaken identity. There was no proof, there was nothing in there. The girls didn't admit to anything when they were grilled on cross-examination. They admitted lies and inconsistencies early on in the investigation, but then, as the prosecutor pointed out, they had to be really good actors to stick with this story. And you know what defense counsel said in his closing argument? You're right, Mr. Prosecutor. They are actors. They were real good actresses. They've been acting all their lives. That's the context that this argument is in. And so you can't ignore that. I think oftentimes courts are too quick to jump to the harmless error analysis for that reason. They struggle like we are with deciphering whether we've gotten too close to the line, whether we've crossed the line, and we're like, well, it's harmless error. And I mean, this court could do that, and I think it's reasonable in light of how the case was presented to go there. But I don't think I think the Court of Appeals did it right in saying, look, in this context, there was nothing erroneous here. Yeah, you maybe could use better words, maybe it could be a little more clear, but we're really talking about two diametrically opposed views of the evidence. This is how the case was presented from voir dire on. Both attorneys were setting up the jurors for their particular theories, and it came down to were these girls lying or weren't they, and why? And both the closing arguments of both attorneys explored those avenues at great length. I would say within the confines of the jury instructions that the jury presumably followed. And, you know, so again, that's a long answer, but you could do as the court did in common and say, look, this ultimately is not plain error. Even if it did cross the line, but I think, again, the Court of Appeals correctly said we find that he did not misstate the legal burdens in light of the evidence in the case as it unfolded here. And they're told these arguments are not evidence. You decide this based on the law. You decide this based on these instructions that we're sending in there with you. And don't be swayed by sympathy, passion, or prayer. You think the prosecutor is going over the line? Don't be swayed by that. You decide this based on these instructions and the evidence that you heard. And yes, you were instructed. The defendant has no burden here. He doesn't have to testify. But again, to point out, even though the defendant didn't testify, he was able to present his uncross-examined claim of innocence through his police statement. That he got up, he presented through the police and the detective, he was innocent. He didn't do it. And then the state drew out on cross of the officer, well, do you have any, did you ask him? Was there any reason? He had no clue. He had no idea why they'd make this up. We were friends. Why did they make this up?
Counsel, can the prosecutor tell the jury that they may not speculate about why a witness might lie?
Can the prosecutor tell the jury you cannot speculate about why the witness might lie? You know, the instruction says you have to base your decision on the evidence. So if there's, you know, if you've got nothing, you know, you can say you can't speculate unless we've got something to base that on. Now, the defense attorney...
Even when it comes to just a question of credibility.
Pardon me?
Even when it is just a question of credibility, jury cannot speculate.
No, I think they, well, they, when it comes down to, you know, this isn't a case where we're not really sure what happened. We're not sure if they were confused or if there were, this was a case where it is black and white. They were lying. And if there's no theory as to why they would lie, I think it's fair for the state to the prosecutor to say that their theory is they lied, but we haven't heard any reason why. They testified and they stuck with their stories. They were cross-examined. And then the defendant, when he was interviewed by the police, couldn't come up with a reason. So you can't speculate. I think that's fair, and I think that's consistent with the reasonable doubt instruction.
Counsel, I heard the question to be, essentially that can a prosecutor tell a jury that they cannot speculate as to motive for lying or why they lied? That's what I understood the question to be. Now, we've got a little problem here because credibility of witness instruction instructs the jury that you can consider possible motives for falsifying, right? So how does that play out against what
I think you can't. I think what that instruction says is motive is relevant. And so I would say lack of motive is just as relevant. So if you have motives, clear motives, say in this case where there was some huge falling out between these girls and Mr. Bell at, 6 months before the assault, fine. But if you're going to, again, this is not, the state didn't prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, you must acquit. These girls are compulsive liars. This is a witch hunt. But we don't have any reason why they're lying. And my client can't come up with one. I know of no case law that under those circumstances the prosecutor can't comment on the lack of a motive. And I would think that the credibility instruction allows for that as long as you say the defendant didn't put in any evidence or the defendant didn't testify but based on the evidence that you heard, did you hear any motive for them to make this up? Neither did I. I don't see why that's unfair. I think that's a fair comment in the evidence as it came in. It directly refutes the defense theory that they are lying as opposed to they're mistaken or they're confused. I have yet to see a case that says that the defense theory is irrelevant in analyzing the propriety of the prosecutor's argument. And I think that's what's important here, is that, he anticipated the defense argument, and he accurately anticipated it, but that was based on how the case was tried on both sides from voir dire on, that both sides knew, all right, it's he said, she said, but it's even more, it's compulsive liars versus a guy who claims he didn't do anything. And you, the jury, have to figure out if these teenagers are making this all up. And that's, viewed in that context, in the entirety of this record, as in everything that was before that jury, including the instructions that they had in their hands that they presumably read, understood, and followed, and the Seventh Circuit is very emphatic about that in the Common case, that if they had those instructions and they understood them, then we, that's of great significance to us. And it should be here, too, whether this court agrees with the Court of Appeals that there was no error or if it agrees that with defense counsel that maybe he crossed the line once or twice in the phraseology used, that if you move out from those words and phrases into the bigger picture here, there's no error, or at the very least, there's no reversible error here. So if there are no more questions, I will conclude my argument.
Thank you.
We have not challenged the instructions that the court read to the jury. They were correct. The problem is that the prosecutor was also effectively instructing the jury on the reasonable doubt standard, and those instructions were wrong. And as the United States Supreme Court recognized in the seminal case of Berger versus United States, a layperson, the common juror, would have every reason to believe that the prosecutor is correct in what they say, because they would believe that the prosecutor is faithfully observing their obligations.
And, counsel, you, at pages 3 and 4 of your reply brief, you indicate what the prosecutor's failure to faithfully state what the law requires might occasion. And that includes foreclosing the possibility that the jury might conclude that the sisters probably were telling the truth, but the inconsistencies, delayed reporting, or the lack of corroborating evidence created doubt about Bell's guilt, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how is that not saying that the girls were lying?
That I was making that argument in terms of how a jury, even in a case that is really tried on the theory that the sisters are either truthful or not truthful, how a jury could still acquit without concluding that the sisters are lying.
So if the if the sisters said X occurred and X makes the defendant guilty, you say the jury might conclude that the sisters probably were saying that X is true, but the inconsistencies, delayed reporting, or the lack of corroborating evidence created doubt about X.
Yes, because
how is that not saying the sisters were lying?
Because a jury might even believe, as I wrote there, that these witnesses are probably telling the truth. We think they probably are, but I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt because of other things about this case that cause doubt in my mind. And when that's the circumstance, they have to acquit. No. And what the prosecutor told them is you can't acquit unless you conclude that they're lying. That's a false dilemma, as the courts have called it.
I might be having a philosophical difficulty here, then, because I don't know how you can say, yeah, I think they're probably telling the truth about that X occurred, but I don't really think X occurred. How can both of those be true at the same time? Doesn't that violate the principle of non-contradiction?
I don't think so, because the jury has to decide the credibility of the witness.
Yes.
I would say that's probably a large scale of where witness credibility may fall. And a juror may conclude, I'm absolutely certain the witness is telling the truth. Probably more often, they may conclude that I think maybe they are. But that doesn't mean the state has proven each element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think you might be conflating two important but not entirely logically dependent concepts. So one is that the state has to prove beyond reasonable doubt that that the defendant's guilty, right? So you have to hit a certain quantum of evidence. The second piece is this piece of evidence true or not, right? And it either is true or it is not. If it's true, it gets added to the pile of evidence whose quantum might eventually equal guilty, or it's not, in case you don't put it in that pile. But you don't get to have reasonable doubt about where you put that piece of evidence, right? You either put it in the pile or you don't.
Well, I think the jury, when determining whether the state has proven the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, is looking at all of the evidence. And I don't know how else to say it other than that they don't have to conclude that the witnesses are lying in order to acquit.
Okay, but no. Let's not conflate the two. Let's focus on whether or not they believe the witness. Okay? If they believe the witness, they need to put that evidence in the state's bin. If they disbelieve the witness, they don't. But they need to do one of those two things, right?
Well, I think they can believe strongly. They can believe wishy-washy. They can believe, I don't know, I'm not convinced. I don't think that a juror has to have an absolute black and white, this witness is telling the truth or this witness is not. There's so much that they can consider when assessing credibility. I wouldn't be surprised if in trials, jurors are frequently unsure whether the witnesses are telling the truth but they're still able to render a verdict. But if they are unsure about whether the witness is telling the truth, then, and that's really what the case was dependent on, then they must acquit. It's not that they have to conclude they're lying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for very good, spirited arguments, as usual. You both are here before us on a number of occasions, and we always appreciate all the hard work that you do with your briefs and your arguments. So we will now conclude for the day. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:05.